First, we thought the Russians had it. Then, we thought the Chinese had it. Then, we thought detente had ended it. But, oh no, oh no! Here it comes again! Here comes the Colonel!
Yeah, right. Give me a break. You know, we share this building with the studio down the hall that does auditions for Comedy Central. They sneak in here once in a while and sabotage us. Welcome back to the second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to have an old friend, Stephen Snyder, the late Stephen Snyder, who was on this program in 2009, and we're going to bring him back. You're going to love it. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set. Rummage around in the coin jar for just a minute for today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help
you? Yes, we have awakened the spirit of the fountain who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. Yes, of course, that's why we threw in the coins. All right. Oh, spirit of the fountain, here is today's query. The Gulf of Sidra. Yes, you know the Gulf of Sidra very well, don't you? Located in the southern part of which sea? The Gulf of Sidra. Where is it located? The southern part of which sea? Oh, spirit of the fountain.
I have given you my answer. And now you may tell me.
We cannot fool the spirit of the fountain. Everybody knows this, don't you? I mean, the Gulf of Sidra, located in the southern part of which sea? The Mediterranean Sea, of course. All right. On with our program. Over the years, we've had some really outstanding guests on this program, many of them just plain unforgettable. One is my dear friend, the late Stephen Snyder, professor at Stanford University, expert on climate change, who he'd been studying since 1970. And at times it's good to bring him back. Here is a segment from 2009, maybe 10 months or so before he died.
Now, among other things, he's professor for interdisciplinary environmental studies at Stanford University, but he's internationally recognized for research in climate change. He specializes in climate science and has consulted with federal agencies and or the White House staff, and going back as far as Nixon, includes Carter and Reagan and the first George Bush, Clinton, the newly retired Bush administration. But, Steve, I don't see the Obama administration in there anywhere. Do you not consult with them?
My vita reflects the status of a standard professor with insufficient administrative help. We just haven't updated it yet. Yes, I have two or three very good friends in the administration, and even though I've been talking with them for years and they don't really need to call me to get my advice, once in a while they do, so I've been talking with people literally inside the White House too.
Okay, well, I want our listeners to know that you've been actively involved with the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, with the United Nations, of course, environmental program. But recently you kind of took issue with some of the things that they're doing. You co-authored Uncertainties in the IPCC Third Assessment Report. Are you having some issues with them?
Well, there's no person, place, or thing that's perfect in anyone's opinion. And I think the IPCC has done about as good a job as it was capable of doing, given the circumstances, that it operates on the basis of consensus. By that I mean about 120 countries get together and they approve the reports, and they have to go over the summary for policymakers word for word. Well, how are you going to end up getting precisely the language the scientists want when you've got countries like the small island states facing extinction of their culture and being driven off the islands as the sea level rises, who want the report stronger, and then fossil fuel-dependent countries like China and Russia and OPEC and the U.S. and Australia, who are very careful to keep the report a little bit less scary. So what it ends up being is a lowest common denominator in sort of the middle, cuts off the edges, the extreme concern and the happy world. But the chapters written by the authors don't do that. It's just a summary for policymakers. My complaint that was reported in the New York Times is that scientists, by and large, are a culture of conservatives. I don't mean political conservatives. I mean that they are evidence-driven, and therefore they generally withhold opinions until they have a lot of accumulated evidence. I'm one of those guys, too. However, we are operating through the IPCC at the request of 120 governments who don't want us to wait until we have a consensus before we warn them of potential risks. They want us to tell them everything. But I keep arguing consensus is not about conclusions, that is, how many degrees warming is going to be. Consensus is how much confidence the legitimate scientific community has in those conclusions. And those things that we know well, we should say so. And those things that are speculative, we should say so. We shouldn't just put next to each other a strong affirmative statement and then, oh, but we don't know anything about precipitation in Kansas, even though both of those are true. We know it's going to warm and we don't know what's going to happen to precipitation in Kansas because our confidence levels are completely different. Precipitation in Kansas we have very low confidence in. That it's going to warm we have high confidence in. So I've been arguing with my colleagues to be a little bit more forthcoming about the range of what can happen, but to be absolutely clear when we don't have a lot of good knowledge that that's the case. And it's society's choice to judge whether or not it wishes to take the risk, just like it's individuals' choices how much insurance to buy. There's no right answer. That's a political value judgment about whether you fear more investing present resources in a problem that may not be as bad as we think, or whether you fear more not investing to slow down a problem that could come out worse than we think. And there's no right answer. And I keep telling my scientist colleagues, it's not our judgment to choose whether to be conservative or not in that. We just tell everything and give our confidences. And that's a hard pill for some of my colleagues to swallow because they've been raised in the notion that we don't talk about it till we know for sure. And I think that's actually making a political judgment for society that's inappropriate. That's been my argument with IPCC. It's not been over the quality of the scientific assessment or the openness of the process. It's been, in fact, that we've been too inside the club and haven't been forthcoming enough about the wide range of possibilities, good and bad, that can come out there until we have very, very high degrees of evidence, and that shouldn't be our judgment alone.
Well, what we know for sure, do we really know for sure that the Earth is heating up in a way that is unusual, not the way it's done over the millennia, but I mean a really dramatic heating we're going through right now? Is that really happening?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Colonel. Let me start with what we know for sure and work down to what's more speculative, and then I'll come back and make certain that I tie up that in the way you asked me the question.
Okay.
We know for sure from the thermometers of the world and from the fact that 95% of the mountain glaciers are melting and the Arctic sea ice is dramatically thinner than it was 25 years ago, and Greenland is melting on its sides much faster than it's accumulating ice on the top, and those plants and animals that have been measured to be changing, the roses are blooming a little earlier in your grandmother's backyard, and birds are coming back a little earlier in migration. So IPCC said, and I agree with it, that it's unequivocal that at least in the last 100 to 150 years the Earth is warming. But the big question there, so that's well established, essentially beyond a doubt. The tough question is how much of that is due to Ma Earth and how much of that is due to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that question we can't answer directly by data because Ma Earth, being the perverse lady she is, she just gives us what happens. She doesn't tell us how much is her and how much is us. So what we do is we now have to construct a theory based upon data of how the world works. So we look at all the data we can that we've gathered over the last couple of hundred years about the atmosphere and all the data we can about the oceans and about the ecosystems and the chemistry. And we codify that data given our knowledge of physics and chemistry and biology, into rules. These are mathematical statements of how we think the system works. And, of course, the word that we call for this virtual reality is a model. So the models are run on computers. Now the question is, are the models any damn good? Well, in order to figure that out, you try things with them. You let the model predict June versus January, and lo and behold, it makes June in the Northern Hemisphere about right, 15 degrees warmer than January. If it didn't do that, we'd throw it in the garbage. It has the tropics warmer than the poles. It has the deserts drier than the forests, and you know, in the middle of continents having extreme climates when the middle of oceans don't. If they didn't do that, they'd be crap. But the problem is, the future is going to be driven not just by the processes of the past, that is, changes in a little bit of changes in the energy output of the sun and volcanic eruptions to throw dust in the stratosphere, plus the Earth's orbit around the sun. Those we all know, and we put them in our models, and the models actually do a fairly good job of reproducing what happened. But in the future, we're going to have a very significant addition of greenhouse gases and hazes and land use changes. That's never happened in the past at the rate and in the way it's happening now. So there is no data on the future, so we have no choice but to use the models. So what we do is we test the models. We do what we call fingerprints. That is, we'll say, okay, model, what should have happened if human activities were part of the story? And the model predicts that because of ozone depletion and greenhouse gases, that the stratosphere, that's up about 10, 20 miles up, should cool and the lower atmosphere and the surface should warm. If the sun did it, which I'm sorry to say is a routine explanation in the op-ed pages of the Wall Street Journal without any other points of view, then what would have happened is it would have warmed the stratosphere, the middle of the lower atmosphere, and the surface. That's not what happened. Stratosphere cooled, lower atmosphere warm, just like the model said. That's a fingerprint that human activities did it. Is that definitive? No, because supposing we were completely ignorant, we knew nothing, then there's a 50% chance the stratosphere warms, a 50% chance it cools, 50% chance the surface warms, right? 50% chance it cools. I'm talking about the last 50 years. Mm-hmm. So there's a 25% chance we got it right for the, you know, by luck. So that's not enough of a fingerprint. What else do we do? We ask the models, okay, models, predict for us what happens in the relative warming of low-latitude continents, high-latitude continents. Predicts low-latitudes warm up less than high-latitudes. Did that happen in the last 50 years? Yes. Again, 25% chance that it's a fluke. How about, what else does it predict? It predicts night warms up more than day. Did that happen? Yes. Another 25% chance. Now you see we got three of them?
Mm-hmm.
That's not 25% anymore. That's 25% times 25% times 25%. It's much more likely than 9 out of 10 that in the last 50 years, humans are part of the recent warming. That's how it's done. It's done by doing these so-called fingerprints, and there are three or four more of them. They all line up. So the scientific community considered it to be, and the words they used were very likely in our language means more than 9 out of 10, that humans are part of the story, or at least the majority of the story, but only in the last 50 years. Nobody claimed anything before that. Now, your question was, it's warmed up before. Absolutely. It was warmer 5 to 9,000 years ago, especially in the desert areas and in the middle of continents, than it is now. And some people, it was much warmer in the whole planet 125,000 years ago, 1.5 degrees Celsius, like 2-3 Fahrenheit. And people said to me, well, it's been warmer before, therefore this is just natural. Well, the trouble is, there's no therefore there. I'll give you an analogy. 3 years ago, I had this horrible flu over Christmas, killed my whole vacation. It was called the norovirus. You ever have that? That stomach?
Yeah,
I had 102 for 3 days.
Mm.
If the every global warming in the history of the planet were all the same, all natural, all due to the same cause, then that logic says that every time I have a fever, it's always due to the same thing. So the next time I have 102 for 3 days, it's got to be the norovirus by that logic, right? Couldn't be respiratory, kidney, malaria, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do in science is we try to figure out why do we have a fever? Why did the planet change? And we know what happened 5 to 9,000 years ago. The Earth was tilted more in its orbit, therefore more sunlight came into the high latitudes in the summer than now, and in fact the very same computer model that we used to project the 21st century predicted what actually happened in paleoclimate. So not only do the events of the past not refute the present, they in fact support the argument. And that's what the scientific community does. Now, this is never reported because every time I tell reporters, why don't you cover this, they say it's too many numbers, the story's too complex. So people are getting these snippets of information from the deep ecology groups only telling you the well-established, and the enterprise institutes and the coal industry only telling you the speculative part. This is not a problem that's bipolar. You know, it's not Democrats versus Republicans equal status. Scientists will argue there's multiple potential outcomes. The two lowest probability ones are the end of the world and good for you, the ones that get all the battle in public, and everything in between is more likely, and we spend most of our time trying to figure out the relative credibility of each of those arguments. And unfortunately, in the media debate, which is based on an advocacy model, they jump to the extremes. No wonder people are confused. I can't blame them.
Well, I have to ask you, you know, it's talk about a global problem, but isn't there evidence that as the North Pole is warming, that the South Pole is actually getting colder, and that makes it not a global problem?
That's not true either. There's been several studies recently done. The reason that the South Pole was uncertain is because there are so few thermometers there that it was very difficult to put them together into a coherent and meaningful average. Whereas in the north, where most of us live, we have so many thermometers that the signal is very clear. You know, it's what we call a sampling error. If you don't have very many samples, you can't tell what you're measuring. Something may be going on. However, very recently, there have been long-term analyses of those thermometers that existed, ship tracks, and other things, and they have now concluded that although parts of Antarctica are cooling, just as the middle of the higher northern Atlantic Ocean is not warming up very much, there are always going to be parts of the Earth that are exceptions, the bulk of the Antarctic is warming slightly. By the way, the models predict the Antarctic warms much slower than the Arctic because of the massiveness of the continent and the fact that it's surrounded entirely by ocean, which has much, much longer thermal lag. So the fact that Antarctica is slow is not only expected, it's validating the theory rather than invalidating the theory, because it's what was predicted. But the most recent studies, which have now been published in peer-reviewed journals, we're not talking about op-eds and blogs, which carry no credibility, says that even the Antarctic is warming, but not all of it, just on average a little bit. However, the most warm place in the world, unfortunately, is on the peninsula on West Antarctic that sticks out in the ocean. And the reason I said unfortunately is that's where there's very rapid change in ice, which affects sea level. So it's not an exception. When somebody says, oh, but wait a minute, I have just falsified global warming. I have shown that it's cooling in, you know, X region or Y region. And I can say, I just falsified Ronald Reagan's victory in 1984 because he didn't win Massachusetts and Washington, D.C. We're talking about science is not based upon exceptions. It's based upon preponderance of evidence. The preponderance of evidence that it's warming is overwhelming, and there are some exceptional places, as you'd expect. Just as I said, that 95% of glaciers are melting. Do the 5% that aren't say that, oh no, I falsified that the glaciers are melting? Of course not. But there are people who actually make those claims and can even get published, and the claims are scientifically ridiculous.
Okay, I've heard it, you know, described that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, then that the Earth is kind of getting like a sunburn. In other words, it gets all this heat, and we're just now starting to see the effects of it. Do you subscribe to that train of thought?
Well, I don't know quite know what you mean. Sun does change its energy, but it doesn't change it by very much, and it goes up and it goes down. And there were periods when the sunspots and the energy, the extra energy associated with that was correlated with temperature, and there are periods when it was not correlated with temperature. And most people who look at that problem, and it's been studied very carefully by the scientific community, feel that the claims made by those that the sun is responsible are just simply false, because the evidence is very weak, it's speculative and assertive, and as I said earlier, if the sun did it, why didn't the stratosphere warm along with the lower atmosphere? And that's not been answered by that group. Some say, oh no, it's not the total energy from the sun, it's cosmic rays and the magnetic fields do it, and they have this elaborate theory, something like the celestial spheres before Galileo got the telescope out, you know, and showed that in case, and where there's this long chain of logic where the change in the magnetic field affects the particles from the sun, which then affects a cascade of chemistry which amplifies by a factor of 100 by changing the clouds. Well, that's all very nice. It's even possible. But there is zero evidence to suggest it's happening, because if that were the case, then you'd be able to measure a change in the clouds that would create enough energy to explain the observed warmings. And there's no such evidence. So again, the community does not ignore these critics. The community looks at it very carefully. What they're doing is ignoring why they are being discounted, which is that their evidence is very weak. And that often leads to that. Now, what about dust and smoke? That's part of your question. I don't know if you call it a sunburn, but I began my career in 1970. And we didn't know warming from cooling in 1970. In fact, as a grad student, I worked for a guy at NASA, and we put dust from human pollution, you know, burning coal, oil, and gas with sulfur. Mm-hmm. Gas doesn't have sulfur, but the others do. And that makes hazes, the industrial smogs, and they make the world brighter, therefore they cool the planet. Well, we didn't know whether that one over carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas that heats the planet. So we did a calculation, and we assumed that the dust and smoke were everywhere in the world, and that carbon dioxide was the only greenhouse gas, and we concluded it was going to get cooler. And, of course, lots of colleagues yelled and screamed.
And, of course, it didn't get cooler. It's getting warmer. The late Stephen Snyder, my dear friend, professor at Stanford University, appeared on this program in 2009, just about 10 months before he died unexpectedly from a pulmonary embolism. Next week, we'll play the second half. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
The way I think about it is, don't assume that you know what the customers want. Have that conversation. Look out there and don't just try and give them a product that you've always given them. Try and give them a product that they need and they value. This is Michael Quinn, Vice President of Strategy and Chief Technology Officer for Encore Electric Delivery.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you. I